Mr. Shapiro, this is Tatiana Little. She's one of my success stories in terms of diversifying the Latino pipeline. She was an undergraduate and a first-generation college graduate at UMass Boston. She's now in a PhD health services EPI program at UMass Medical School. They have a booth in case people are thinking about that. But a lot of the work we're doing is really thinking about who do we educate to become agents of change, both in improving their own lives and in becoming inspired to do something about the conditions in the community. We happen to be talking today about the ways our team was affected and activated by appreciating the number of our community members, the number of my undergraduate students, the number of people in my community that are living in the shadows because of papeles. Because we are, I think I know a lot about being a Latina immigrant, and then I discover how little I know about a whole population that's targeted by state-sponsored violence. So I wanted to share with you how we have progressed through this research, but Tatiana heard me present this at our Latino Research Institute. She wants to make sure that I don't digress so that we can get to the findings of our study. So I'm going to try to move very quickly now and say, Tatiana's going to tell us a little bit about the UMass context within which she became empowered to do public health research.
So UMass Boston, where we come from, is a really interesting institution because it's the only federally recognized minority-serving institution in New England, and we're designated as a community-engaged institution with faculty and researchers who are using CBPR and participant action research as well. And we're also associated with the Gaston Institute, which it is an institute devoted to gathering information about the Latino condition in Massachusetts, from economics to school, housing, demographics, to inform public policy and have some change. And at UMass Boston, we have about half of our students identify as non-white, and most are immigrant or second generation. And we think that we have a number of students who are undocumented, and some of the research that our team has done, we're seeing more students come out. So those stories are being heard. In Massachusetts, almost a million were immigrants in 2007, comprised 15% of the population. About half of Massachusetts residents are foreign-born who were naturalized citizens, and 66% were established immigrants who have been in the U.S. for over 10 years. And immigrants account for about one-third of all Boston households, and about one-fifth of all children have an immigrant parent. And about 15% of the immigrant households were living below the poverty line. And so we have still persistent educational and health disparities in Massachusetts. For example, the high dropout rate for the English language learner students. We also have health and mental health disparities, especially with biomedicalized health and lack of specialty and diagnostic approaches, and also limited cultural competence. And we have some progressive legal and social services that work with the community to offer services and educate the public, but we're still battling some policies that are not progressive. Esther?
All right. So I want to tell you a little bit about the experiences and projects that radicalized us. So I think people were aware of the massive ICE workplace raids that we were targeted in the New Bedford area, and the Urban Institute has done some wonderful follow-up research on some of those massive workplace raids. So one of the things that we are arguing in this work right now is that given failed federal policy and the intensification of the hunting of human beings by the Obama administration, the violence of deportations has increased under the Obama administration. We realize that while we're waiting, and we've been waiting for immigration reform, we have started to think about how do you make this a local process where you look at what can you do at the local level? What can the state do? What can your county and local governments do? And then what can all of us who don't want to just be bystanders anymore, who want to do something to protect the health of these people living in the shadows of our communities, So one of the things that we found in follow-up on the New Bedford raids was that our Department of Social Services was the only one so far nationally that at a policy level stepped up to say, we are for the unification of families. Our Department of Social Services made sure that no children were separated from their parents and used that to release a lot of parents. So that was a very important moment, and sadly that has not been a national policy. In fact, although we've communicated with social work as a field, that's been part of what we've been doing, because social work stands in a very important way. There are a lot of parents who are incarcerated through documentation status issues and lose their children because they are called to hearings that they can't attend. So that we realized was our moment to start thinking about what are some of the opportunities for all of us to start thinking about where are there points of contact that have implications for policy change. And I want to say one thing, which is I'm a clinical psychologist, and I was called in the aftermath of the New Bedford raids to provide crisis mental health services. Crisis mental health services are not part of the solution, they're part of the problem. Because thinking about these populations in terms of their needing healthcare system-based trauma services is a travesty. And that's part of what we realized, because we were called to do mental health services, and we realized that what people want is what you're about to see. So we've been doing a bunch of qualitative interviews leading to the recommendations, but I wanted to tell you about being a clinical psychologist in recovery and a born-again health promotion researcher as a result of this work. So the students and I have been doing these qualitative projects, partnering with the Gastón Institute and with community-based organizations, as well as with our Department of Social Services and other groups. I think all of us have been very moved by the emergence of all of these undocumented college students. We estimate that we may have as many as 15% of our Latino students at UMass Boston are undocumented, because that's an affordable option for us. Tariana was trying to get me to skip through more of this to go right to the recommendations. So let me just say that immigrant integration is something you can push in a lot of places. Part of it is getting people to see that documentation issues are a component of culturally competent work for Latinos and other immigrant populations. The idea that tener papeles is only one part of a continuum by which you are a person navigating a social world. So we are using more of a life course, settings, and wellness as fairness approach. If someone would like the millions of citations to back this work up, please let us know, and we'll send you some of the bibliography and some of this fine research. So I think one of the big things that I was glad we worked with the Urban Institute on those 2010 reports, and the only thing that I think I persuaded them to do, is don't report harm in terms of trauma, because that doesn't lead you to any services that can really change the conditions in which people live. And we were very pleased that they decided to frame these things not in terms of these clinical issues, but in terms of these social determinants of health issues and human rights issues. There are a lot of family strengths that we can build on, but this idea of figuring out where are families showing up, we're finding that undocumented families live in a lot of fear. Their citizen children have unique burdens in terms of helping take care of the family, and they think very carefully about where they can show up that's safe. And so one of the things that we can start doing is thinking about where we can find them, where they feel it is safe, and then declaring ourselves, signaling that we are safe people to work with and to speak with. And so a lot of what you're going to see here, and that's very consistent with what we've been discussing, is so we need to take life course and settings approaches that are holistic wellness oriented. We get funded by disease categories, and we have to start thinking in terms of holistic family wellness. So we're big fans of Isaac Pilatensky, who does community psychology. And so what I want to do is just, how much time have, all right, so let me just give you some highlights of some examples. I got permission to present this work in United here because they just finished their contracts with Northeastern Food Workers. So Unite Here is a hotel and food workers union that has been organizing on college campuses because they feel like that's an important opportunity because you have progressive faculty and progressive students you can partner with. They successfully organized Northeastern University food service workers, a significant portion of which, maybe as many as 30%, are undocumented. When I first got involved with this, I was really freaking out about the undocumented workers, and they promised me, and they really delivered on that, that they write in both high-quality health care access and documentation protections into their contracts. And I have to tell you, because I worked as a translator helping in some of their community organizing sessions, my nephew is their researcher, so that's how I got involved in this. He's like an opposition research guy. That's what he did with his public health career. He's doing labor opposition research organizing. And one of the things that was really incredible was watching people go from the first organizing meeting where they were carrying the consequences of going to evening meetings when they've been working a couple of jobs to keep their family afloat in one of the most expensive cities in the country, and to see them begin to share their stories of how they were struggling in to keep their families afloat in terms of employment, to realize that by coming together that they were underpaid, that there were sexual assaults going on the part of management, that they were let go, of course, for any questioning of that condition, and that they could come together and become powerful. There is nothing better I have ever seen for evidence-based mental health practice than a proper union contract, and one with these kinds of protections. So the work, I think, is going to continue now that they've had such effective impact. So I wanted to give you that as an example in terms of employment. Educational issues, you want to think about education across the life course. I happen to be a big fan of Avance, which does the child programs in terms of bringing in the madres and the abuelas so that they have educational opportunities as well as opportunities to support the positive development of their children. Boston has some funding focused on early intervention and Thrive in Five because that's our response to social determinants of health, is to try to give educational access. That's a huge issue in a state whose economy runs on elite education. So the focus on early intervention and connections for English as a second language and adult literacy training linked to health education has been very important in Boston. We did, after UTS was finished with you guys in California, they showed up in Massachusetts and got our English language learner classrooms closed after a year. That's all you get. That's had a huge impact. But one of the places where we've done outreach to undocumented families is in our Hispanic Writers in the Schools program, where kids and their parents are brought together to do Spanish language literacy. That's one of the places where we've heard some of these very moving stories, and it's a place for people to connect to empowerment-oriented educational resources. We have started, I think all of us have been very moved by the appearance of all of these undocumented college students who would like to stop living in fear, who would like to step into our society more fully. But I'm very worried because ICE has a college student program, so I don't even release, I don't include my data on how many of our students reported documentation issues. I think that's a very delicate thing. We actually had to move somebody who was in the registrar's office who made it her business to look for student inconsistencies in their visas We had to move her to another department. So you have to be very aware, not only of where are your allies, but where are your points of special vulnerability. Health and Human Services is another place where, because citizen children have a lot of different kinds of coverage, you can reach families, say, through pediatrics departments. Taking care of their kids' health and schooling is one place where people will show up no matter what the dangers are to themselves, even though the ultimate danger of being separated from your children is so frightening. So one of the things that we're thinking a lot about is, how do you start training not just the social service outreach people but also providers to start thinking about documentation issues as a component of culturally competent care? We have started to have providers who were undocumented at one time in their work to step forward and speak up about their status. A young woman who's in a graduate program spoke up at the Latino Caucus today and received our gratitude and a round of applause, because I think the more of us speak out about those issues, the better. Partnering with community-based organizations is really key, because they are a point of trust. Those community-based organizations and the churches are a huge point of trust for the delivery of safe resources. It's very important to think about resource navigators, many of whom are not fully employed because of documentation issues. We just have to be really aware of how much burnout you can have once you start to open those conversations. People get really overwhelmed. That's one of the things that we saw in the aftermath of the New Bedford raids. Legal services people in Boston were amazing. They had a lot of experience with Central American refugee and Central American solidarity work. So legal services have been an outstanding distributor, not just of work related to legalization, but also of mental health services related to asylum seeking. We have to start thinking about the fact that half of Latinos, people remember that Pew report, half of Latinos say that they are concerned about somebody in their family or close network might be deported. We have to start speaking about these issues in terms of this broader level of burden. We need to stop thinking about disease categories and start thinking about holistic no justice, no wellness approaches that include resource rights, human rights, and empowerment. We have found participatory action research has been a really important tool, because one of the things that happens there is that our students from marginalized groups start to think about the importance of their lived experience as a source of knowledge. It's very empowering and leads the way for other kinds of multi-method work, and it strengthens positive pathways between knowledge, mobilization, and accountability to making an impact in the community. So thank you very much, and I look forward to our general discussion.
Thank you to our panelists. We heard about the good, the bad, and ugly for older Latinos living in Skid Row. I'd surmise that an older life in Skid Row might be prevented by greater health in childhood. So we transitioned into looking at nutrition education and physical activity and arts efforts to reduce childhood obesity, with preliminary results suggesting mostly first-generational families who are mostly Spanish-speaking populations with high rates of obesity with room have some room for improvement with these interventions. We then heard more about the role of place in obesity prevention and the role of social and environmental determinants that are actionable and can be shaped by policy when we show up to make a difference and take part in the process. And finally, we heard about promoting services for some of the most vulnerable among us, living in the shadows during an anti-immigrant context, and ways that we can be radicalized and called to action to address the unique burdens of these populations. So taken together, we see the types of efforts that we are working to make sure Latinos are included in policy So now we'd like to take our remaining, we have 20 minutes, for your questions as we identify policies and systems change that advocate for and create healthy opportunities for Latino communities across the life course. So if our panelists can return back up, I would be happy to take your questions for them. I don't have a mobile mic, but it's a small room. Or if the panelists have questions for each other.
I do have a question. I was interested in discussing about the homeless issue in the context of, it was clearly that you had more narratives about men, but you had some data about the women. Were the narratives, were you able to capture any narratives of women?
Let me see. Okay. Yeah. Okay. We had six women. Latinos were hard to find in Skid Row to begin with. And the women were even harder because they seemed to have more mental issues. And their stories are very different from the men. Our next project is looking at women, younger women and older, younger Latinas, older Latinas, and then we're going to make a comparison with African Americans in the homeless area. So we're going to gather more information. But from the woman, what we gathered is that they have a lot of mental health issues stemming from the reason why they ended up in the U.S. And many of them came because of violence, because of war in their countries, because they were brutalized, because they lost family members, or even on their trip to the U.S., migrating through their U.S. They were raped. They were abused. They were abused as nannies still. And so their stories are very different from the men. So our next project is just specifically looking at women. But I did want to say, apart from the question, that I like this panel very much because I see how bit we're all interweaving and there's something that all of us can take from it. And I like very much that Dr. Flores also said, because what we take from our study is that there, all the homeless are telling us, there's a sense that we haven't done anything illegal. Their stories are very sober. We're not into drugs, and they're not. The Latino samples we have are not heavy into cocaine and all the other that tend to, if we generalize about the homeless population throughout the U.S., these Latino men and women are not heavy into drugs. We only found one that claimed about marijuana and one alcohol. Okay? There's lots of other issues going on with them. They're saying, we didn't do anything illegal, we've never been arrested, we've never done this and this and this, and yet we're being treated this way. I just want to be able to understand what's available for me. So they just want the opportunity to get training for a job and to be able to access services that others have been able to access.
Are killing us in terms of policy, in terms of research. because lo que le conviene, what's convenient. So the cultural argument is very convenient in the dominant cultural discourse. And I, you know, in the homeless, it was clear it's social inequality, it's lack of access, and what you were saying, what Dr. Flores was saying, what you're saying, Esther. And I think the other thing I just want to mention is the large majority of Latinos, who are poor, Mexican-Americans, a large number are not immigrants, a large number of the other Latino population are not immigrants. And we can't forget that, because I also feel it's a little political game with the immigrant stuff that the rest of us are forgotten, which is the overwhelming majority, which is 70%. So I wanted people to respond to the, what is the alternative narrative? How do we grab it to use for our own political benefit?
Well, you know, I'm just going to take a stab at it because I think, of course, you know, Ruth, you and I have to deal with the funding realities of NIH or USDA and our funding our work. And in that construct, you're really finding a narrative that it's fairly well defined in terms of looking at some of these cultural issues. But I think how you pose the question, in other words, the fact that we're really looking at, although we're looking at these structural issues, we're looking at some of these cultural issues, we recognize that we're bringing the narrative of, and I think George is doing this, is a community informing the discourse, which has really shifted, I think, how we're looking at this. In other words, just by tweaking in the context of looking at the narrative of how culture is valued in terms of using art, that's a very different narrative than having somebody from the outside create the narrative of how to describe your community. In some ways, I think that as researchers, and I say that because you and I are researchers, we have to be more subversive in bringing in, if you will, the cultural narrative. Clearly, we need to test things that are, by virtue of our disciplinary background, certain variables. But I think what we're seeing is, and we don't have time to discuss this in our own right now, but that we really are looking at these qualitative narratives that structure the choices that these families have. And it's not something, and so that's why we're giving them, if you will, a menu of issues. You know, we picked, see, our communities that we're doing our work in are largely the immigrant community. They're the farm worker community. Right. But if you look at farm workers' community, whether they're in Arkansas or New York, they're going to be primarily immigrant, largely Mexican immigrant. And that, and, you know, that is a narrative that is very specific to the agricultural industrial complex that we have in the United States. It's not something. So I think one of the things we have to be really aware of is situating what we're doing, because I do think that there are very localized issues that we can't generalize. In other words, there's a narrative of the urban, there's a narrative of the diversity of the population, and then there is the narrative of the local. And the narrative of the local is really, I think, you know, again, bringing to bear how there are certain conditions that can create the right choices for change, that elevate the capacity, elevate the innate capacity of agency that our communities have. And I think that the way we structured this work is we structured it with this idea that we are not, and this has been the biggest struggle. Every intervention that I mentioned is an intervention of negotiation, not an intervention of one dimension. Now, you know, how you tell the narrative, and I think that's what you're saying, at the greater, so you're not dealing with the culture of poverty versus the structural determinants, I think that's where I think that becomes a lot more complex, because as you get into the broader policy-making arena, they tend to reframe it. I think what I've seen, which is amazing, as we spend more time with these very high-risk communities, and I think this is what George is suggesting in his work, is that if you engage them in the level where they actually can utilize their power, they begin grabbing that power and beginning to reformulate in their own eyes what the issue has to be. So it's something that I don't think there is a one fit solution. I think part of the approach is that we're shifting our design to more of a community-based design. I think we've always had that, but it's becoming more articulated in the kind of projects that we're dealing with. So it's not just the social determinants model. People talk about the social determinants. That's a descriptor. That's really a descriptor of how to look at an issue. But once you get into the community,
The real issue is really looking at the social capital that's there that's going to formulate that model. And I think that's really, when I'm looking at the work that we're doing now, we are really, if we're really engaged at that level, you're beginning to realize that it is becoming redefined. But to answer your question, I don't really know how to shift, and you're asking, how do you shift that narrative at the broader policy level to those who are outside the community? And I don't think that's really clearly defined. In other words, we here can discuss
it. I think that the floor is trying to
do. Right.
I agree with everything she said.
Right.
And it's a very good lead-in to why we have even this Health Happens Here or La Salud Empieza Aquí going on, because we think there's some communication that changes that narrative too, that translates to everybody. So people can understand better that we're talking about an opportunity agenda. We're talking about removing the barriers that have created these inequities. And those two things, opportunity and barriers, mean a lot to Latinos, because we, in fact, have come to this country because of the opportunity. And we, in fact, because of our age and youth, are looking for opportunity. It's not built around entitlement. It's not built around service. Our notion really is we want to take these opportunities into our hands and make something great out of it. And David Hayes says this, all of the Latino researchers from before have said this. It really is the spirit of America. It's how America was founded. And we're in the embodiment of that very spirit of wanting to take this country forward and be the productive hard workers, the people that contribute back to society. But you're throwing barriers in front of us, the political barriers, the economic barriers, the barriers of social inequities, and making it harder for us to do what we need to do in order to make America great. Remove those barriers, take off those shackles, and we can make America great and contribute just as much as any immigrants, as any other population, and maybe more so. And that's the struggle. That's really where we're talking about our right to achieve and our drive to achieve is real. So to us, to say Health Happens Here means it puts it into the community's hands. It puts it into your very hands to move this agenda, to become part of that spirit and that drive to change things. That you don't have to wait for a hospital to give you help. You don't have to wait for an insurance company or a surgery. The health, the education, the job factors, all of those things can come out of your hands if you take them into your hands and move your communities and use the power of collaboration, that commitment to move things together socially. And don't be afraid. America Bracho was talking about how maybe each of us that are now in our professional positions have even forgotten somewhat of what the struggle that we've come through to get to where we are, that we are part of that community too. We are all parents. We're all sons and daughters. We're all part of that struggle. Don't forget that, and that you have to speak for your community and act for your community when it comes to vote, when it comes to putting into action the things that you can do professionally so that you can make the kinds of changes that need to happen. Don't forget that, because too often we do take the path of convenience, and we take the path of social getting along to get along instead of doing what might be uncomfortable and breaking those barriers down, which is something that we have to commit to do for our entire lives.
I go back to a statement I made when I had breakfast this morning with the Latino caucus, that I would like to see, my wish list, a better integration of the various disciplines. I'm a nurse by training, a nurse practitioner, very firm, very proficient, ethicist, Western model, do this and this and this. But I gravitated medical sociology. And so, you know, I'm often told that I'm unfocused because I work with farm workers. I do this, I do that, I'm with the homeless. I go where the community is, and this is what I've been doing for my life. I don't see a separation, but I'm constantly having to shift and justify how this is a study about humans, not about immigration, not about Latinos, not about nurses, and that we have to integrate together. And so I'm very pleased that I'm here and hearing this, and that Carlos now, you know, he's in Chicago State Philosophy, but he's now thinking of applying for law school. And who are my biggest backers in LA but Chicano Studies Research? Not nursing, not School of Medicine, not NIH, not those R01s, but Chicano Studies and MALDES.
Mexican American Legal Defense Educational Fund. They are very interested in how the outcomes will lead to some policy changes. So here we're talking about merging nursing, sociology, immigration, Latino knowledge, and law.
If I can make a pitch, add something and make a pitch for your book, Ruth. So I think that one of the problems we have, because I'm a clinical psychologist, new to public policy or macro approaches, I think one of the messages of this panel is that everybody has to have a hand in policy change. Policy change is not something for the elite. It's not something for people who run things. All of us can contribute and participate, and we are starting to learn a lot more about barrier and opportunity. So one of the things that I wanted to make a pitch for is I'm using Ruth's book on the Latino family, Latino family perspective.
American society.
Yeah, thank you.
I have a Latino Caucus website too, under resources.
And one of the things that Ruth uses is an organizing framework that bridges the power from below and the power from above is intersectionality. Now, I know intersectionality is yet another term that we don't know how to use, but having looked at it closely as it's come from legal studies, critical feminist studies, and also thinking about individual lived experiences of intersecting forms of social oppression, it is a tool that's transversal because part of what we're looking for is how you move simultaneously power from below to leverage points for change and whatever impact we have from above in terms of planning and policy as we think about the embodiment, the consequences of being part of these social structural levels. So I want to recommend that as one of the forms of transversal organizing we've been thinking about. And then the other thing is, I came out of the Latin American edition of Our Bodies Ourselves and looking at how social movements begin with the things that people are trying to do to solve problems and move towards the inspiration to come together as a group to change your society. There are people who have never read Snehendu Kaur's analysis of 80 women's organizations that changed their countries. You ought to take a look at that because he has a beautiful empowerment framework about how you start from the individual and multiply insight and power to make change happen. Mothers Against Drunk Driving and Mothers of Plaza de Mayo use very similar techniques that we don't learn enough from the women's movement because we do tend to separate out all these disciplines. So I just wanted to make a pitch for that book and for this kind of conversation as a way to build those frameworks.
Sorry, I have to interrupt our dynamic discussion because we're out of time. But perhaps you can come up and direct any remaining questions to our panelists if you get to them quickly. I just wanted to put in a plug for our remaining two Latino Caucus sessions. We have one at 2:30 today and one at 4:30 today. Well, these are the ones remaining for today. So you can look for us in 226, 10 Community Health Workers, See the Solution to Family Wellness, and Community-Based Participatory Approaches Using Social Media for the Health of Latino Population. So if you just thank our panel one more time.